Joseph, can you hear me?
I think I'm supposed to respond. Wait, is it Papa? Can you hear me? Like, anyway, it doesn't matter.
I think I don't even know what that's from.
I don't want to play into whatever that is. Now,
Dan. Don't take the bait. Yeah,
I will not take the bait. Now, Dan, I want to be absolutely clear. Before we start, since we're doing a movie, we're continuing sort of on a trend.
No, we're not continuing on a trend.
Well, I mean, this is related to other movies that have been discussed.
Loosely based on some source material.
Yes, very loosely. But I just want to, before we get started, I want to get out in front of any problems. Especially since we live broadcast these things, and say that there is the possibility that this will be rated stronger than PG-13, you should cover small children's ears or whatever.
What do they say on script notes? If you're listening in the car with your children, you should not.
Yes.
Save it for later.
Yes, this is more for later.
Like those candies now and later, but just the later part.
Those are such terrible candies. I love them when I was a
really
kid.
Bad.
Yeah, especially the banana one. For some reason, it does not taste like banana. But
as a kid, you have the patience. You're like, it's okay. I will moisten this for a good 20 minutes before it becomes edible.
it's just like the worst taffy that you've ever had.
Is it a taffy based product?
I thought
it was just like a really, like when Starbursts are too bad to sell, they sell them to Now and Later, and then Now and Later holds them for like a year and a half and then sells them.
Yes.
Dehydrates them a little bit, maybe puts them in a dehydrator so they're not the same shape as the Starburst.
Yeah. They are definitely a taffy based product. But they're not as good, anywhere near as good as getting, you know, saltwater taffies from the boardwalk or whatever. But
Amanda brought home some what do you call it? What's your favorite thing? That prickly pear flavored taffy a couple weeks ago. It was real good. I'm still thinking about it.
I've never had a prickly pear taffy, and
it's good.
Prickly pear is not a favorite flavor of mine. I just like to mention it because it annoys you.
Why does it annoy me?
I don't know. I mentioned that I was having a prickly pear margarita one time, a prickly pear marg, and you went off
marg,
on a tangent.
The prickly pear marg does not irritate me. The bothersome part is you going like, look at me, I'm drinking like an Arizona local. I'm having a prickly pear margarita in a glass shaped like a cactus. And it's like, that's not, I'm not a stereotype.
Remember Jason bought the prickly pear syrup from one of those horrible kitschy places.
I believe after our Twitter poll, you are legally obligated to call it syrup.
I don't believe that is legally binding because it is a Twitter poll, sir. But yeah, this is that was the thing. And then Jason also bought the cactus glasses with the little arms. And they're adorable. I don't personally have any affinity for cactus shaped stemware, but they're cute for exactly one purpose.
Prickly pear flavored margaritas.
Yeah. Well, or other margaritas. You just don't want to have like a Manhattan in it. That would be weird. But
it'd be a pretty large Manhattan too, because they're kind of deep glasses, aren't they?
Yeah, pretty deep. Yeah. I suppose you could make like a lime panna cotta or something in it. serve that.
Can you transfer a panna cotta out of the cooking vessel into the cactus without ruining it? Or are you imagining creating it in the cactus?
Oh, Dan, you don't cook it. You have.
What am I thinking of? Not a panna cotta then. What am I thinking of?
Like, are you thinking of flan or like?
Yeah, I'm probably thinking of a flan.
Or any other custard. This is the thing where you pour the liquid into the vessel and then you refrigerate
it.
You stick it
in the fridge. It's like grown up Jell-O.
Yeah, because it has gelatin in it. But that's neither here nor there because we should get into talking about.
Should we?
Well, I mean, let's just get it over with. I don't want to delay for like 45 minutes and then talk about the movie, because then I'll just make it take longer. Because I know, for a matter of fact, that as we go through this movie, someone is going to have something to say. And that someone is going to be one of us, because there's a 50-50 shot one of us will say something.
Do we have to go through the whole thing?
Well,
we just talk about what it is. It's, you know,
okay.
Just do like the first paragraph from Wikipedia, not the plot section from Wikipedia.
The synopsis.
Yeah. Wait, I got it right here. Chili Palmer helps the widow of an executed friend to resurrect a record company using the talents of young and talented female vocalist and songwriter. That's poorly written.
Yes.
The plot is complicated by several facts. Bullet point one. In a loan shark subplot from Get Shorty of Who Owns Who, Chili makes deals and owns all of the players as a producer. What in the hell? Who wrote this? This is not helpful. Russians are trying to kill Chili because he witnessed the execution of Athens.
That's the executive. That would have made more sense had they used some sort of sentence structure that introduces you to that name prior to this, so you could link those two things. Yeah. But whoever did this is, I guess, working on a second grade level, because that's not how you should do it.
Fell asleep while typing, because then the next bullet point is just Athens Record Company owes money to a gangster/producer, Sin LaSalle. And then it stops there. That's the whole synopsis.
What more do you need to know about this movie, Dan?
You know, this is a 2005. I would like to emphasize 2005, because I think that weighs very heavily into the mistakes that were made. An American crime film adapted from Elmore Leonard's novel. So this was an Elmore Leonard novel. It's not just a standalone sequel to Get Shorty.
I suppose, as we have identified so far in our discussion, and they're not reviews, we're not classy, in our discussion of Elmore Leonard-based movies, we have not read any of the Elmore Leonard novels that these movies are based on. So if it says that in this thing that can't use English right, then that must be correct.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just doing some due diligence here. I'm typing in. No, I don't want. Wait, where is?
This is my favorite part of the podcast. Dan Googles.
Right. I'm trying to.
Yeah.
Be cool book.
Be cool book.
A novel by Elmore Leonard.
And I'm gonna put some quotation marks in there.
Yeah. So this exists. This came before the movie.
But I don't know how closely these things hew to one another, because there's a lot of stuff in here that, as written and delivered, seems very different from Get Shorty. So I don't know how
different
much
writer.
Yeah, I don't know how much of that is the writer adapting the material and also putting in stuff as part of that adaptation. Compared to the original.
This is also from the writer who also wrote Analyze That, the sequel to Analyze This.
I mean, he also has some other bad credits too. Let's not just highlight the one.
21. But, what is 21? Is that who is this person?
He worked on Drowning Mona. But yes, anyway, this is adapted by or written by, or whatever.
Yeah, right. So it's supposed to be a sequel to Get Shorty. It's got most of the same people. Mm-hmm. It's got all of the same scenes, a lot of the same dialogue. It's just a big piece of shit.
Now, we're still PG-13, because we haven't used the F word twice.
Right,
now,
we only said, oh, God,
I want to talk about the beginning of this movie, because I feel like
I would like to briefly talk about the rating and just say that the PG-13 rating for this movie is such bullshit, because the things that were PG-13 in 2005 don't really track anymore with movies. They say a lot of things in this movie that you should not say in a PG-13 movie, and the idea that teenagers saw this movie in 2005 makes me angry.
Well, I think the part of the problem is that some of the things that are said have less to do with the specific words used as much as it is with the general writing of the scene, except for a couple of instances where specific slurs are used.
There's a lot of them.
Yeah, there are a lot of slurs. Now, as a gay man, I have to say, I don't super love characters just tossing around the other F word in these movies.
No.
It doesn't.
It's not even funny when they're like, oh, look at this character. He's an asshole. Look what he's doing. It's like, maybe that gets you one, but there's what, like 30 of them in this movie?
Well, not 30, but there's more definitely more than necessary. The necessary amount is zero, but there are many from several characters. Now, part of the problem is that this is the writing trope of we have this awkward situation where there's a masculine bodyguard kind of guy who needs to pretend to be effeminate because the joke is that he's gay, and that is a bad trope. Now, Dwayne The Rock Johnson, credited as The Rock on this movie and credited as Dwayne Johnson elsewhere, would go on to make the same mistake again when he is in Michael Bay's Pain and Gain, where he is also playing a gay character who is a big buff masculine guy who just happens to be gay for the laughs, for the funny stuffs. And so that makes it very bad, because not only are you using the slur, but you're saying it's okay we're using the slur because we're delivering this fully rendered character, and it is not that. It is just a bad thing, because it just makes that person the butt of the jokes, and that person isn't a person. So it's a double bad. But that also goes for several other layers of this film. But I don't know how much of that to blame specifically on Gary Gray, or how much of that to blame specifically on Peter Steinfeld, the screenplay writer. But there's a lot of bad taste that could be spread around equally between everyone here.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Gary Gray went on to do some better things than this.
Yeah, he sure did. And I don't want to necessarily fault him entirely with this because he didn't write it, but there are definitely some issues of execution where you're like, oh, I guess this is just a music video now. But that's...
He made a lot of those in his career.
That seems to be a reason he was selected for this project.
I would say so.
But it really is very strange in the course of the film, especially if you are to slot this in some sort of a viewing party environment with Get Shorty and Then Be Cool, because then your mind would be blown by what was going on in this one, because it's simultaneously referencing the first but being bad at it in a new and spectacular way. And
yeah, while we had some positive things to say about Get Shorty, its credibility as a movie was hanging on by a bit of a thread, based on a lot of the cheesiness of the time. And this movie is tumbling into oblivion. It no longer is holding that thread. It has, I can't even express how cheesy and bad it is. Like there are parts of it where it's like, this looks like the kind of movie my mom would have written or something. Like, it's just everyone's sitting around going like, gosh, look at us. We have succeeded in our wildest dreams. Hooray, look at everything that is going so well. It's like, Jesus, this is not how people talk. This is not how movies should be presented. This is nonsense. You can't believe any of it.
I think your mom could do better. I haven't met your mom. The beginning... Right. Well, that's a different podcast. But the beginning of this,
save it for the after show.
The beginning of this. Does she still listen to this?
I don't know. She's not an incomparable member. Is all I mean.
Hello, Dan's mom. The beginning of this movie, I feel like, is important because it sets the bad tone for everything else, and. It really highlights all of the problems, because we immediately start with a sequence where we meet James Woods and John Travolta. John Travolta's driving his Cadillac, a car that he had longed for in the first film when he wanted to get a rental car, and he got the Pontiac, whatever it was, the bad minivan. You get the Cadillac of minivans. And and that was a funny line in the first one. And unfortunately, that is repeated. But they're driving in his Cadillac on, I guess, Sunset Boulevard. It appears to be a stretch of it. And James Woods is acting up a storm. And by that, I mean he seems to be on something. Now
he's trying to be like an over-caffeinated Harry Zim from Get Shorty.
Yeah, he's not doing as good of a job as Gene Hackman did. And he's a
think James Woods has ever done anything as well as Gene Hackman. But yeah, you know, when it opens, you're kind of like, oh, look, it's John Travolta here. He's wearing his outfit. He's Chili Palmer again. All right, sorta. And then you see James Woods sit next to him, and you're like,
different hairpiece.
John Travolta, okay, all right. And then James Woods says some stuff, and you're like, do you have to be here right now, man?
No.
It turns out he doesn't have to be. Because a weird Russian guy in a toupee steps out of a car and shoots him a bunch of he tries to shoot him a bunch of time.
But you're getting past the important part. James Woods and John Travolta drive past a billboard for Get Lost, which stars Martin, the Danny DeVito character from the first film. And John Travolta has dialogue where he laments doing a sequel, and sequels are always bad. And he also says that it's PG-13, and that means that they can only say fuck once. And so he says fuck once, and then he might as well have winked at the camera, because that is all that is, because this is a PG-13 movie, and it's just hanging a lantern on it, and it's hanging a lantern on the meta-ness of this commentary and how he wants to get out of this and get into the movie business, out of the music business, because the movie business is over and he's over the sequels and all this other stuff. And it's
might be a worse use of the F word than Ready Player One.
Yeah, this is, I mean, I don't care if you want to waste the singular F-bomb you have in ratings territory, fine, put it wherever you want to. My problem is you had dialogue about using it specifically before you said it, which is wrong, because then you're saying you're above the material that you're writing, so you're going to do this way. And this movie, tonally, feels like so much of it comes down to people involved in the production of it feeling like they are above what they are making. And
you know exactly what this scene is. It's from another Travolta movie. It's the opening of Swordfish, where he is lamenting how Hollywood makes terrible movies, and then that's like his speech before you're walking out of the coffee shop with the bomb thing. Same thing.
Yep.
It's the writers going, "Nah, I'm a writer and I'm better than the MPAA, and I went to film school."
Yeah, it's
probably about 2 months before they wrote this movie.
It's really bad writing. And
I'm sure they're lovely human beings. I take that back, but this movie is a pile of shit.
I mean, I don't know. I've never met Peter Steinfeld, so I'm not judging him personally one way or the other, but his writing in this specific case, he appears to be writing in a way where he considers himself above the material that he is writing. And that is an irritation to me, because you should just know what you're doing and own it. And in this case, they're saying we are above this, and we're not just going to hang a lantern on it. We're going to hang like the biggest freaking lantern in the world. And then we're going to hang another huge lantern. And then we're going to keep hanging lanterns through the course of this film. And we're going to burn down Los Angeles with a bonfire that has been created from all of these lanterns.
I mean, at a point they stop hanging lanterns and they're just like, let's take that scene from the other movie. And then we'll move it from Harry Zim's office to the Uma Thurman's office, and we'll do the exact same thing. Don't mention the Russians. She mentions the Russians. I'm going to sit in a chair over here and be ominous and say calming things, and it's exactly the same scene. It's just stupid.
Yeah, and this is another problem with this is laziness when it comes to that. Like, these aren't clever references where they subvert your audience expectations, because my the subversion of that expectation that I would have had was like somebody would have shot John Travolta in that scene where he's telling Cedric the Entertainer to be cool, the title of the movie.
Or if you want to do a reference, you get one, but there are so many of them in this movie. There's so many. Like, he does the look at me, no, really look at me thing, what, like three times? Oh my God. This writer is Haley Steinfeld's dad.
Who's Haley Steinfeld?
She's a very popular musician who was in the a cappella movie number 2 and 3.
Okay. I'll take your word for it.
Oh my God. Really?
I guess.
Oh my God. She was the star of the Bumblebee movie.
Okay.
She was in True Grit.
Oh, wait. She was the girl in True Grit?
Yes. She is a grown-up human being now who has like songs on the radio that you've probably heard.
I liked your performance in True Grit. I'm sorry you've like died. But anyway, moving along.
This hurts me.
I don't know why. her acting performance has nothing to do with his writing skill.
No, I'm just picturing, like, you know, the way kids get embarrassed by their parents when they're growing up. Like, part of her embarrassment is like, Dad, don't tell people you wrote Be Cool.
I mean, I don't know. Maybe she finds it charming that her dad wrote a line about wife beating as a thing a cop said to a pawn shop dealer. But anyway, let's just address this film. So we get this opening. We get James Woods mercy killed. And I say mercy killed for us, the audience, because he's not really in much of this. There's a flashback of him very briefly later. And we're just like, yay, no more James Woods, because he's irritating in this performance and just in real life. But I believe at this time he was still employable. So it would have been a good thing for him, I suppose. He was also supposed to be a different character. He was supposed to play the Nick Carr role before he was supposed to have a surgery for an aneurysm. So he had to pull out of that, and he was just assigned this lesser role of being Athens. And so that's fine. He's not in much, and then he's gone. And Chili Palmer, very chilly, addresses the Russian mob shooting of his friend who was trying to pitch him on a movie about his own life by just standing there and smoking a cigarette as his car is destroyed. Several other things are destroyed, and then he counts the bullets to make sure that he won't get shot by the Russian mobster guy, and then the Russian mobster guy gets in his car and leaves. He just smokes a cigarette until Debbie Mazar arrives, and they chit chat because apparently they know each other, and they talk about the situation, and he says toupee and describes the guy and the black eye, etc. And this sets in motion the plot of the film, such as it is, where a music executive has died, that being James Woods. And Chili Palmer, being dissatisfied with movies and wanting to get into music, finds himself drawn into this void left by James Woods. So he goes to talk to Edie, and we are introduced to Uma Thurman. And I have to say that I like Uma Thurman when she is not affecting an accent. And any time that you tell Uma Thurman to affect an accent, you are gambling with my patience, because there is a lot that is going on here where she is pronouncing words in ways that are not human. And it really makes it hard to buy into the emotion of the scenes that she's in.
Is she doing an accent in this movie?
Yes, she's trying to do a Brooklyn accent. Or her guess of what that is, I suppose.
Does she keep it through the whole movie? Because I feel like...
No, it goes in and out. It wobbles.
Okay, because I don't remember that from the end.
It wobbles like a restaurant table leg. It is not sufficient for what it's doing. And it is stronger in the earlier scenes than it is in later scenes. So I guess they filmed some of this chronologically, and she just got tired at some point, or toned it down on her own volition, or someone gave her a note, but after dailies. But yeah, it was dialed back. How did you not notice that she was doing a funny thing with her voice? That's not what she sounds like normally.
I don't know. Maybe I just don't know what she's supposed to sound like regularly.
What you really need to do is watch Batman and Robin, so you can see her performance as Poison Ivy.
I've seen that. But is that even really an accent? It's just like, be Shakespearean dramatic, but bad.
No, well, she's trying to sound like a 1930s movie actress in that. And it is awful. It is atrocious. But anyway.
Can I give you another quick factoid?
Sure. I love factoids.
Peter Steinfeld, our writer, father of Haley Steinfeld, pop singer.
Dan?
Yeah.
You seem to be very obsessed about the Steinfeld family at the moment.
Yeah. Yeah. You know who Peter's brother is?
No.
His brother is Jake Steinfeld of Body by Jake. You remember with Body by Jake?
Not ringing a bell.
Oh, he did a lot of fitness infomercial-y type things in the 90s and 2000s. He also started a sporting organization called the Major League Lacrosse Association.
There's a Major League Lacrosse Association.
Yeah, there is professional lacrosse, and it was started by Jake Steinfeld, who is the brother of the writer of this movie.
People play lacrosse professionally?
It's a sport. People play all kinds of sports professionally. Yes. Yes, they do.
But they're like wearing like hockey shoulder pads, and they got the little badminton thing.
It's not a bad... Oh, my God. Not a badminton thing. It's not hockey shoulder pads. They're much thinner than that.
Anyway, yeah, so...
it's only been around for 18 years, by the way.
I'm sorry the Steinfeld family has apparently... caused you grief in ways?
Jake is good. Jake is good. He did a thing that I like, but his brother is bad.
Okay, so Jake and Haley are good.
Yeah, Peter bad.
You should just go down the whole family tree. Do you have anything to say about the wife?
No. The hilarious thing is in Haley's Wikipedia page, it refers to her dad as a personal fitness trainer, not a director, and it doesn't even actually link to his actual Wikipedia page.
Well, is he ripped?
Yeah. Yeah, he is. And he's a bad writer. I'm gonna copy this image address here and paste it in.
I don't know if I need to see image addresses.
It's him and his daughter posing in some sort of workout gear that presumably they sell.
Really?
That's them.
He kind of looks like a Ben Stiller in old person makeup.
Like Ben Stiller's New Jersey cousin or something.
Yeah. Now, Haley's hair, I have to say.
Oh, that's not good hair.
That's not good hair. But anyway, not to judge people by their appearance, because that is certainly not what we're about.
No, we just judge them by their choices, and that was a poor choice.
That was a very poor choice.
You know what he looks like? He looks like if you mixed Ben Stiller and Michael Bay.
Interesting.
And a lot of these other photos more so.
Anyway, Dan, stop.
Well, yeah, what was happening in the movie?
I need you to close whatever tab you have that has Peter Steinfeld in it. Just, it's gone. No more wandering.
Look, all your Skype messages just showed up. Anyway, so what we were talking about Uma Thurman's bad accents.
Yes, which I can't believe you didn't notice. But
she's got a Aerosmith tattoo on her lower back, which becomes a relevant plot point later.
Hard to believe. And she's a groupie, former groupie, and...
she just washed their clothes, which is a totally normal groupie thing that people do.
Yeah, lavender water.
She traveled around with Aerosmith washing their clothes.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a thing.
Maybe it is, Dan.
It's not a thing.
You don't know that it's not? Did you travel with Aerosmith?
You know what Aerosmith did not give a crap about in their heyday?
Lavender
their clothes
water.
Being clean. They were drug addicts traveling from town to town.
Anyway. This is it sets up the situation with Edie. They go to the record store and they gotta figure out the books, and apparently they have no money. And Nick Carr says that money is owed, and there's also the Russian guys who seem to want money for insurance. And we are introduced to the intern who explains the photo that she withheld from police evidence for no really good reason, where an insurance guy had lit a Polaroid, or what the Athens character had said was an insurance guy. And of course, it was just the insurance racket, where be ashamed if something happened to this building here, kind of a thing. And that was supposed to be the message that was sent by burning the Polaroid. But this is not really a terrific setup. It just puts Chili Palm in a situation where he needs to try to find some way to keep this business afloat that doesn't really have money. And
yeah, it exists entirely to be like one of the subplots that gets tied back in a convoluted, like, instead of a bus locker this time, they have a pawn shop with little tickets that apparently you can just leave stuff at a pawn shop, like it's some sort of, I don't know, Amazon locker for people to pick up later.
Amazon pawn locker.
Oh, Jesus. So they use that to, like, trick people into picking things up and not setting them up by setting other people up and making it appear that other people did whatever. It's stupid. I just realized also that the $300,000 that they owe Cedric the Entertainer in this movie is the same as the $300,000 that they get off the airline scamming in Get Shorty. So it's just, apparently that's just a good number for Elmore Leonard movies.
Yeah. Unless you say 300,000, not quarter million, which is different. It sounds differently rolling off the tongue. But anywho, we are also introduced to Cedric the Entertainer. And he has a very lovely Gauche mansion where...
cooks pancakes for his daughter.
Yeah, and...
she doesn't like pancakes.
No, she complains about pancakes, which is unusual. I have to say that I love pancakes. I love a soft flaccid waffle, as it were.
I wonder if she's a waffle gal. Maybe she prefers a waffle, and Cedric the Entertainer doesn't have a waffle maker.
She doesn't seem to express any interest in any other particular thing. She just seems to want to complain, which leads me to believe that nothing would satisfy her because she's spoiled. But that's just a guess.
It could be your bias among against small children, but it's fine.
Yeah, I also hate children, so that's a problem. But Cedric the Entertainer gets to have a good little dialogue with his wife where they talk about how it's better than sugar sandwiches and stuff, and she doesn't know how good she has it. And then he gets to go outside to pick up the paper and stuff and say hello to his neighbor. And then a parade of Hummers rolls up with spinners, blasting some inappropriate music for the suburbs.
Yeah, Andre Benjamin is here, and he is... part of the intimidation squad.
Dabu.
Yeah, his name is Dabu. Which, okay. He wears a bulletproof vest and has guns, and his pants are very low. And he's stupid repeatedly for comedy. But they have that one guy that you've seen in a bunch of stuff in the trunk, and he hits him with a spatula a bunch to intimidate him. I don't even remember what he wanted from the guy, but
they're not playing the WMDs enough,
right.
Which is the music group that the fellows are in, Sin, Cedric the Entertainer, represents. He complains that they are not promoting his work enough.
Do we meet that band? Is that supposed to be the large men behind him?
Yes, that is them. That is they. Okay. They are them.
They are those. They are those.
Yeah.
Are they supposed to be like an NWA kind of thing?
Yeah, I believe that is the thing. Except,
is that the reference? Did I get the reference?
Well, except they're the WMDs, because that's a reference to something that was timely and relevant in 2005.
Yeah, incredibly timely and very relevant and very, very useful for a screenwriter.
It's a good critique. So, there's a billboard later with the WMDs on it. But
I totally missed it. I mean, I probably didn't watch 40% of this movie because you don't need to watch it.
I'm not sure you paid attention to most of it, Dan, based on this conversation.
I heard what was happening. And that's all that I needed.
But I hope you got some chores done around the house. Or at least we're catching up on Twitter. But they have that and lets you know that he's a producer who is very serious about his work and is not afraid to push some boundaries when needed. And we also have the weird, silly introduction of Danny DeVito's character again as John Travolta drives up in his Honda Insight, which is his rental car that he received. It is the Cadillac of hybrid cars, he is told, which is not true, and no one has ever said that about Honda Insight. But
I knew a guy who had a Honda Insight and a Lamborghini. Those were his two cars.
Wow. Well, if anything, it's the Lamborghini of hybrid cars. But I mean, the current Honda Insight is completely different from the Honda Insight that is in this movie.
Do they still make that?
They make a car called a Honda Insight, but it is just basically the hybrid Civic.
Oh, right. That ugly thing.
It's not ugly.
It's got a little extra bits and bobs that make it silly looking.
I mean, I have some bad news for you, Dan. If my Elise were up on my Honda Civic.
Oh, are you going to get an Insight?
I think so, for the environment.
Here's the 2012 one. Mm-hmm. This is the one I see around here that looks basically like a Prius. It's got the little like flat butt back looking thing.
No, are you thinking of the Clarity?
No. I'm looking at it right now. 2012, Honda Insight.
But it just looks like the Civic.
No, it doesn't. Oh, I put an extra character on the end of that. This one looks
oh,
bad.
Oh, no. That's the one that looks like the Prius.
Yeah, that's what I said.
No, there's a new one.
Yeah, I see. This one looks just like the Civic.
Yes, the one that's... When I said it looks like the Civic, it's the one that looks like the Civic. It's not the old one. So anyway...
Interestingly, they didn't change the chrome bumper to black like they did on the Civic for the 2019 model. It's fine.
No, they didn't. Because it's not like a serious sports car.
This ugly little one that he drives in the movie is hilarious. I love that they covered up the back wheels for some reason, too.
Well, that's how the Insight was.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because your wheels provide, I think, most of the drag or something, or some proportion of the drag on the car. So to streamline it, they cover part of the wheels. But aesthetically, the market said no to that.
That little silver one that he has in this movie, that's the one that the Lamborghini guy has.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it was not a successful car. And I wonder if someone paid to have this unsuccessful car featured. But
it's funny that you mention corporate sponsorship for this movie, because there seems to be some.
There certainly does. I would say notably the T-Mobile Sidekick. But
and this being 2005, I had to think for a moment. The Sidekick. This was when the Sidekick was done. Basically, that was the Sidekick 2.0 that they had in this one, the one that slid up rather than flipped out the side 360 style. Did I see that correctly?
Yeah, well, it wasn't done yet because Devil Wears Prada is after this, and she's still using it.
Of course, yes. But I feel like it was done culturally, and they were saying, like, oh my God, put it in movies, pay as much as we possibly can, and like to get some product placement, so maybe people will buy this again. And then 2 years later, it was all over, and we have iPhones.
Yeah, well, I mean, but also they sold the company that made these, Danger. The name of the company was Danger. They sold it to Microsoft, and Microsoft made the Kin. Remember the Kin?
Oh, I remember the Kin. Didn't they have one, like, really? There were two. There was, like, a weird little square one, mm-hmm. and then there was, like, a full-size one, right?
Yeah.
Microsoft Kin.
It was.
Oh, this little square guy was so stupid looking. It looked like a palm thing when it was extended, but when you closed it up, it looked like a Tamagotchi.
And it tried to put everything on like a weird timeline interface that was not well received.
T-Mobile Sidekick had that weird proprietary sort of circular based thing that you would like spin around. It was a horrible, horrible user interface, and I think it was black and white. At least the first ones were.
Yeah. Well, this is not. But the important part is Chili Palmer drives up in this Honda Insight and meets Danny DeVito as he is leaving the Viper room. And Danny DeVito leaving the Viper room is talking about Chili's car. And Chili says it's the Cadillac of hybrids, and they have their exchange, and he says, oh, well, you know, it doesn't seem as fast as...
Same scene as the other movie.
Yeah, it's not as fast as my car, and it's like, well, you know, if you're important, they'll wait. And
the only thing this movie was missing was Danny DeVito showing up later in a Honda Insight.
I was really, honestly, waiting for that scene to occur, even up to the end credits. I was a little disappointed.
Yeah, but they were probably like, this movie is an hour and 58 minutes already. We couldn't possibly shoehorn in another scene that is even more useless than some of the other scenes
and
that are actually required.
You can't cut any of this gold.
I could cut so much of this movie out.
There are vast swaths of nothing happening in here. But and I don't mean nothing like in the sense of out of sight where like not much is happening. And I don't mean nothing in the sense of Foxy Brown where I'm sorry, not Foxy
Jackie.
Brown. Jackie Brown. Foxy Brown was the character Pam Grier played in the 1970s. So anyway, in Jackie Brown, like I had complained that it didn't feel super tight or anything, but like in comparison, this feels like there's so much wasted space because there's relatively little interesting happening even when there's supposed to be. Whereas I feel like in Jackie Brown, sometimes occasionally interesting things were happening. And so you perk up and pay attention to that. So that is a difference I feel in terms of pacing. This movie foregoes interesting things. He goes into the Viper room and he hears Linda Moon and loves Linda Moon and she's in a
girl group trio singing covers of I don't even remember what because who cares.
Yeah, but that's the point, is that it's supposed to be bad that she's singing these covers and bad that she's in a girl group. And her loudmouth manager is played by Vince Vaughn, who is how should I say this? In the words of Christina Milian's character, Christina Milian is the Linda
titular
Moon.
Linda Moon.
Yeah, she's not titular. The movie's not named Linda Moon. But
it's her artistic name. You think it's her real name? I don't think so. I think that's her stage name.
But anyway, she explains to Chili Palmer that Vince Vaughn's character, Raji, thinks that he is more closely affiliated with other ethnic cultural milestones than he is.
The words she says is he thinks he's black.
Yes. I was trying to dance around that, but
that's what she says in the movie. It's okay.
That's what she says. But that's
one line from this movie that we can repeat.
And Vince Vaughn, the only thing worse than Vince Vaughn in a movie being unpleasant is Vince Vaughn being in a movie and acting unpleasant on purpose, because he does it to the nines. He's just way out there on his unpleasantness. Like there's no holding back on his unpleasantness. He's shouting constantly how unpleasant he is, literally.
Yeah.
It is really grating in an unpleasant way to watch. Not just because like, oh, you're supposed to hate the character. It's like as a moviegoer, I'm not enjoying the experience of this. It's not a character I love to hate. It is someone I don't want to see on screen. It is a completely different experience. So anyway, he is being a loudmouth about her contract, and he's being awful, and he pulls on her arm and does all this other behavioral horribleness. And this sets up a situation where Chili Palmer wants to get her out of that because she's talented, and get her on a music contract with him. So he does what he does other times and just goes up and says that she's out of this contract and whatever, and you're just gonna have to deal with that.
Look at me, because I'm serious. Look at me. She's done with you. She's with me now.
Yeah. Look at that pristine Widow's Peak hairline that he has. probably shouldn't have drawn so much attention to it. But
I do you think it was intentional of the screenwriter to hang a lantern on the plugs versus toupee thing later?
I don't know. I'm really curious.
I love that Travolta's reaction was like, that's fascinating. Now can you help me with the dead body?
They should have really had a discussion about, like, you know, blending in your hairline. But Anyway, he they're having this exchange, and of course that is not to shame anybody who chooses to.
No, it is merely a reference to the fact that John Travolta is a well-known toupee purveyor.
Yeah, for a very long time. A little weird about it, but so anyway, he
call him overzealous.
No, but he certainly makes some choices, and they have their exchange, and then Dwayne the Rock Johnson, as the bodyguard, Elliot, gets up, and he's supposed to beat up Chili Palmer to make sure he knows that this is Raji's contract interpret for whatever. But the problem,
like Gandolfini in the other movie.
Yeah, the problem is this is exactly like Gandolfini in the other movie. The only twist that they decided to try to put on this is revealed later in a scene when we are introduced to Harvey Keitel. But this is a situation where John Travolta does like a weird fake neck thing, and then he's like, "Oh, I'll get you a thing with this thing and stuff." And Dwayne "The Rock" Johnson is like, "Oh yeah, sure, that'd be great." And so he doesn't really like go all out on beating up John Travolta. And then we're introduced to Harvey Keitel, who is in his music whatever office with the staff of very attractive women, shouting about how attractive women are over the phone on his phone call.
He's wearing a lot of sleeveless t-shirts in this movie.
Mm-hmm. There is
not appropriate for his age.
Now I have to say, he's pretty fit for the age that he is in this film. You don't need to show everybody everything. It's okay.
And he's got the long hair. Mm-hmm. And just like he's decked out like a guy who has been just like drinking and doing drugs well into his 60s and really should know better.
Well, but I think that is part of that character.
It's totally the character. Harvey Keitel himself is not embarrassing as this character.
Right. I am not blaming him for that. I feel like that is just him playing into this role. What I do think is pretty silly is the dialogue he's given to say, especially when Raji comes in and they have their conversation. Vince Vaughn comes in and they have their conversation about the situation that has unfolded with losing Linda Moon, and that it was Chili Palmer. And he says that his bodyguard even, you know, tried to stop him. And then Harvey Keitel leans real hard into the homophobia, which is unpleasant. But it happens. And then he says that he's going to set him up with a guy, Joe Loop, who's going to knock off Chili Palmer. And Joe Loop is played by Robert Pastorelli. And this is his last film role. I did not know this. He died of a drug overdose before the movie premiered. He is in this movie eating stuff a lot and not really chewing and swallowing in a good way.
He has a soup bowl full of coleslaw and Cantor's deli.
Yeah. Well, I mean, when I go to Nate and Al's, that's how they kind of give it to you, is kind of like a big bowl of coleslaw.
I don't think the intention is for you to just eat it like it's spaghetti.
No, I don't. I think you're supposed to chew more is basically it.
Or, you know, put it on another plate with some other stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. Going hard on this coleslaw. It's not good.
I mean, I've never been to Cantor's, though, so I don't know how they serve their coleslaw.
For shame.
Oh, okay. Look, it's all the way over on Fairfax, Dan.
Uh-huh.
That's minutes away from me.
Literal minutes away.
Nate Nell's is much closer, so I go to Nate Nell's. But
don't triangulate. Yeah, I want people to know where you are.
I'm literally in Beverly Hills. But did you know that the downtown area of Beverly Hills is called the Golden Triangle? It says that on some city maps, but
that's kind of funny.
Yeah, it is pretty funny. The problem is Nate Nell's is going to close and relocate because the owners are retiring and they're going to sell the property for like a gajillion dollars. And so it's going to relocate to a lesser property, and it'll be different. So I don't know if I'm going to like it. Also, Nate Nell's currently is a little on the dilapidated, not really cared for side. So it would be good, I guess, maybe, potentially, if somebody cared a little more. But we'll find out.
Dilapidated is okay, though. It's part of the charm.
Maybe. Have you been to Nate Nell's?
No. I was just looking at it right now.
Have you been to Cantor's?
Oh. I've been to Cantor several times. I was trying to copy and paste the address from Nate Nell's website, but the address is an image.
See? Dilapidated.
Dilapidated indeed. Oh, down here in the footer, there's an address that I can copy.
Yeah. They used to, at one point, they opened more locations. There was like one in Sherman Oaks or Encino or something. It has since closed. And then they had...
it's across the street from Cheesecake Factory.
Yes, but across in a different way than you were thinking, like on the same side as well.
Yeah,
I describe it.
All right, yeah, same side. It's just the entrance is, yeah, okay, I see it.
Yeah, so Larry King frequented there for some time, but I never saw him there. I never saw anybody famous there.
Okay, so here, this is Rodeo over here, huh?
It's on Beverly.
Yeah, no, I'm looking approximately.
Oh, yeah,
in the area.
Rodeo is this one street over.
So it's a block. So I've been very near this place.
Yes.
I've just never been there.
Not a huge reason to go there. They've got like a big deli counter where you can get your meats and hamantaschen or whatever and go with it. Or you can sit down and get a Reuben. I like the Reuben. It's plenty of delicious turkey pastrami. Well, I order my Reuben with turkey pastrami, which is unusual because usually people get it with corned beef.
Huh.
Yeah. But anyway, not important. The important part is we notice that he's nearly choking on his food because later on, he does. But in this whole thing is about how, the hit on Chili Palmer went awry and, a Russian mobster was murdered, who was going to hit Chili Palmer. Who was going to hit Athens, I guess. Maybe. It's unclear.
Yeah. They wanted money from him, but he beat him up, so they killed him.
Mm-hmm.
But then why do we care?
It doesn't matter. Anyway, it sets up the complicated interplay of these forces.
Well, they get mad because one of their guy accidentally dies in Chili Palmer's house because of the hit from Harvey Keitel, which they don't know about, so they just probably assume that Chili Palmer did something to their friend, so now they're mad at him.
Yeah, which was botched by Joe Loop.
Joe
Loop didn't.
Two shots through the window, hit him in the shoulder, but it was the wrong guy because he's probably a coleslaw in his eyes.
Yeah, and so that doesn't go well. And there's a confrontational scene with Vince Vaughn where they're shouting language that should probably not be used around all those old ladies. Because we keep getting cutaways to them being startled by the language. But they resolve to...
They should have cut to somebody who said, "I'll have what he's having." I'll have a bowl of wet coleslaw.
Man. But they set up that he's going to give him the advance for the hit ahead of time now, but he's going to go follow through on it this time, but they're going to meet a parking lot. And so they meet at a parking lot, and they go to hand him the money. And then Vince Vaughn tries to act threatening by having The Rock take out the baseball bat that he's got, because when Vince Vaughn had threatened him in the deli, The Loop had said that he would take out his Louisville Slugger and smack him across the face. And so that inspired him to tell Dwayne The Rock Johnson to go pick up a baseball bat, which turns out to be a red aluminum baseball bat. And that red aluminum baseball bat is made fun of by The Loop and says that don't send, I think he says like, don't send a queer to go get you a baseball bat. And he says like, don't worry, it's not your fault, you tried or something. Anyway, it's bad dialogue. And
by the way, there's absolutely nothing wrong with hitting somebody with an aluminum baseball bat.
Not really at all that I could see. I believe it actually causes more damage than hitting somebody with a wood bat, but
it's probably louder, but yeah. I don't think you're really trying to be discreet when you're hitting people with the baseball bat.
There's not a lot of give to it. And so anyway, there's the non-threatening threatening scene, and he's laughing and whatever and yucking it up, and then he starts choking on his ham sandwich, and Vince Vaughn seizing on this opportunity to get revenge on somebody who has made fun of him.
He was being disrespected, so he's going to let the guy choke on his ham sandwich and also hit him with a baseball bat.
Yeah, he takes this opportunity to beat the crap out of him with a baseball bat till he's dead and choked. A situation that he could not have done under other circumstances because he's a coward and bad at everything that he does. Because he's so cowardly and has such an inferiority complex, he decided to take advantage of this. And so he hit the hitman. As Harvey Keitel tells us later, and
dumped him in Griffith Park.
Yeah, easily identifiable that the dumping was occurring. Yeah,
and if you're wondering how much more there is to this air quotes plot, there's a lot still.
Yeah, because we haven't gotten to the whole thing with the back and forth with Linda Moon and the books and recording and.
She's recording, yeah. But she's a good singer, just like everyone on American Idol, because that's a cultural reference you can make now, but they don't have a sound, which means they need a producer and somebody who can help them out, which later that turns out to be Cedric the Entertainer. He wants to be buddies with everybody.
Well, Cedric the Entertainer first wants his money. He wants $300,000, and he shows up to get that $300,000 and threatens them in the offices. Mm-hmm. And this is where Cedric the Entertainer is introduced to John Travolta because they haven't met in the movie yet.
I was for a minute I had forgotten how they talked their way out of the scene, but he says, you know, come back Friday and I'll have your money. Plus what, Joe?
Plus the VIG.
Plus the VIG. And Cedric the Entertainer's like, oh, really? Plus the VIG, you say? Plus the VIG. Oh, okay. All right, cool. And everyone else in the room is like, the hell are you talking about? What's a VIG?
Well, I looked
it
up.
We know what the VIG is from the first movie.
10%, right?
I mean, it varies. I think it's like lobsters, like market price usually.
But see, that's the thing. Is like, it does vary, but it is generally considered to be 10%.
It's just interest is all it is.
But it's just not interest. There's no interest.
It's like the ante to play cards. You gotta put your penny in before you even start playing to say, like, I'm ready to play.
This is so stupid. Dan, it makes me mad. These are people who don't know how money works.
Plus the VIG, come back Friday.
They don't explain that that this is what's happening either. So there's no final sum, because later on in the film, when Cedric the Entertainer meets them outside of the Mongolian barbecue place, he again mentions the $300,000. He doesn't say plus the VIG or anything, and he doesn't add it to the actual amount. So again, question mark on that. But plus the VIG was enough of an enticement in order to get him to agree to this extension. So it must have been something.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the VIG on $300,000 is not insubstantial. Oh, you know, I looked this up. This is finally one thing that we have that you don't have. It hasn't made its way to California yet. I was going to say, do you guys have a VIG restaurant bar there?
No.
We got five of them here.
Oh, wow.
Plus the VIG. So maybe he was offering a location of a restaurant in Phoenix in addition to the $300,000.
Did it exist in 2005?
That is a good question. But I definitely know the answer to. It's been around for a long time. At least one of the locations has.
Okay. But
so I'll give you $300,000 plus a restaurant bar in Arcadia. Oh boy.
So anyway, this first scene of them meeting, John Travolta tries to do the same thing that he did in the scene where the guys are threatening Gene Hackman. In the first film, where he says, "Ah, I know you better than you think that I do," and then he like says things about
so many times.
Yeah, like I know that you went to this college and you think you're gonna blend in with these people by doing this stuff because you're a man of these things, and it's really awful, and it's a really bad sign if you want me, the audience member, to be rooting for the protagonist of the film to be shot. because it is not, it's not good. That's not a good thing for your film. Cause the writer makes John Travolta so incredibly unpleasant and such a know-it-all, and so above what's actually occurring in the film that you want him to be like snapped back to some kind of reality to be weighed into what actually is happening. But he's so above it that it doesn't make any sense. And he has zero reaction to guns being drawn on him, which is supposed to be like a sign of toughness that he's above all of that. But at the same time, it's like, you can't predict anything about these people. You've never met them before. But he knows them.
But he knows them yeah. better than, he thinks they do.
It's so dumb. But he gets them to leave because he does the big thing. And then they get out of there. They skedaddle. And there's more stuff with going back and forth with Vince Vaughn over the contract and Nick Carr, and it's all bad. All of it's terrible. And there's a scene where John Travolta breaks into Nick Carr's house, and they do the whole, like, hanging out in his place, you know, with stuff and things, and the maid let me in. I don't have a maid. I could tell. And it's like, oh, well, what clever, witty dialogue. But this is, again, one of those shirtless... sleeveless scenes. Shirtless would have been interesting. But
I bet Harvey Keitel's been shirtless.
they have this...
Harvey Keitel.
Well, we've all been shirtless, Dan.
On camera?
Well, no. Not if we're smart about it. But they have this interaction where it's like, oh, I remember you from the thing and blah, blah, blah. Oh,
I shouldn't have Googled this.
Dan?
Uh-huh.
What have I said to you about your browser tabs?
Oh, I didn't click yet, but I'm given to understand that he's done some nude scenes.
Oh.
In his 50s.
Dan?
Yeah, I'm not clicking. I'm going back to trying to figure out when the VIG opened.
Dan, close your browser tabs. Just talk about the movie. Let's get it over with.
I need my materials. I need my resources.
Man. So they
I'm back.
They get rid of this. They get out of this situation with the contract and whatever, and there's this verbal agreement about whatever and blah, 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 but nobody's really caring about these things. They're going to like set up things.
You're
going to
give
things.
Me Linda Moon's contract so I can have it be official and what's in it for me, and she's going to need some help promoting some points on the back end, and that could be expensive. Well, this is the other scene too, but it doesn't matter. It's all like they're trying to, he wants Linda Moon. He already took her, but now he's trying to make it official because everyone's scared that she's under contract still with big bad Harvey Keitel.
Yeah.
Because apparently they know how lawyers work.
Eish. But they also have a scene in here intermixed with all this with the pawn shop where John Travolta finds out because of his friend, who I don't remember the name of.
Who he gives the pawn thing to?
Yeah, was that... What was the name of it?
It was the cops that were investigating the murder or whatever.
No, his friend, the guy in the tracksuit.
Guy in the tracksuit?
The larger gentleman.
Oh, yeah. I have no idea who the hell that guy was.
Yeah.
He was just...
I totally missed his name.
He helped him sit up the dead guy and then drop off the cylindrical package to the pawn shop.
Yeah, but anyway, he had staked it out and told Chili Palmer where they were, so Chili Palmer goes in to meet them, and he notices all the cops outside, and we as the audience are supposed to notice all the cops outside, and he enters, and there's an exchange, and guns are drawn, but none are fired, because John Travolta points out that there's so many undercover cops outside that if they fire, then they're all going to come in there. And so... they chit-chat a little bit by John Travolta punching out the other eye on the guy, so he's got two black eyes now. and they grabs the other guy by the chest hair and throws him into something, and they chit-chat about various things.
Is that real chest hair? As if... whatever.
Could you imagine getting chest hair plugs? That'd be weird.
I mean... the line is there to distract the guy long enough for him to grab him by the chest hair and throw him.
Mm-hmm.
But who would It doesn't matter.
It really doesn't.
What it makes me want to know mm-hmm. is what was going on in the writer's head when he wrote those words.
Bad things.
It's like, Russian guy, he could have an unbuttoned shirt. How could we use that to our advantage? Well, maybe he's hairy. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But, yeah, so the... Harvey Keitel says that the contract is at the pawn shop and he gives him the ticket to recover it, but rather than go there and get ambushed by the Russians or whatever, he gives the ticket to the investigating cop who goes and gets it, and there's like a scene where they yell at each other, and then he gets whatever fake thing was there. Obviously, it's not a real.
Yeah, and The Rock sees all of this occurring from his boot try-on thing.
He's got a blue suit. He's mm-hmm. got a new suit because Chili Palmer said he's going to get an audition at some point.
Yeah, and the music they play for his scene, which is cut in two, which is a little weird because the music goes out and then back in again, but is A Cowboy's Work Is Never Done by Sonny and Cher, which is... a fun choice because it's a fun song, but it's a little weird.
You tweeted that earlier, didn't you?
I certainly did, because it entertained me that it was so dumb. Girl seemed to just get in his way. Those days we weren't considered fun. A cowboy's work is never done. But it's important that The Rock sees this occurring because he gets upset that Chili still hasn't found him anything. And he also gets to go tell everybody about what he saw so that they can connive and figure out what to do, and also send Dwayne The Rock Johnson, who is disgruntled, to go beat him up. By having him wait for them inside of Edie's home, where he has the red metal baseball bat still, he's watching a music video of himself, and he is drinking tea, and the whole joke of this is that it's all effeminate stuff because the scene that he chooses to enact when he asks John Travolta if he can read a monologue that he's prepared is from Bring It On, and he reads two sides of a conversation, which is not the monologue, it is dialogue, he reads that from Bring It On, and John Travolta corrects him and says that he should pick something with men in it, and he should be a man, and he should sing songs that are about men, and et cetera. And it's all supposed to be funny because it's supposed to be like it never occurred to The Rock to do these things. And it's really horrible writing, just bad writing. Like if you put this in a scene in a movie in 2019, you would be laughed at as a artiste. So I can't imagine why it was such a compelling narrative tool to do it then.
The Bring It On specifically part or all of it?
All of it. It's just it's not super tasteful.
I feel like if you were to take that scene and play it at 3x speed and replace all of the actors with teenagers, it could be a scene in a Joseph Kahn movie.
Okay. I'll bite. Why?
Oh, he likes cultural references to terrible things, and Bring It On would work for him.
Well, another thing that's interesting is that Bring It On has a connection to this movie in another way. Do you know what that is, Dan?
No.
You want to take a guess?
Was Christina Milian in that?
In 2009, she was in the straight-to-DVD sequel Bring It On, Fight to the Finish as Catalina Lena Cruz.
That's not even the second one, right?
No.
How many were there? How many times was it brought in?
it was brought in a lot. Just enough for people to sour on it.
It was Bring It On, and it was like Bring It On again, and then Did they do like a Bring It On some more?
I don't know. I'm sure there's a whole Bring It On cinematic universe.
Oh my God. How many do you think there are? Realistically.
10.
There are 6. Oh. I thought there were 3, maybe 4. There's Bring It On, Bring It On Again, Bring It On All or Nothing, Bring It On, and It's a Win It.
When you said Bring It On Again as a joke, there's actually one called Bring It On Again.
That is the sequel. Yeah, I wasn't joking.
No. Earlier, you said Bring It On Again. I thought you were just like cracking wise.
Yeah, no, it's the cleverest possible name because it's the most obvious. So you got Bring It On, Bring It On Again, Bring It On, mm-hmm. All or Nothing, Bring It On, In It to Win It, Bring It On, Fight to the Finish, and then Bring It On, World Cheer Smack.
Well, it's not the last one that killed the franchise, so that's important.
In 2017, because that was 2017 was the most recent one, so it's entirely possible that this film series is not dead.
Hmm. Dan, there's another connection to your favorite director. Remember the movie Torque?
Yeah.
Christina Milian was in it as Nina, Val's new fling,
right.
And friend of Ford.
She was very briefly in that. Yeah,
in 2004.
With the other guy. Mm-hmm. She was better in that.
Oh, she's not good in this. She's not firing on all cylinders.
I'm just going to read this verbatim. The film series expanded its reach when it was made into Bring It On the Musical with music by Lin-Manuel Miranda.
Oh. I mean, I like the first Bring It On, so I'm not trying to say that it's bad.
What was your favorite part about the first Bring It On?
I can't remember.
Mm-hmm. Was it Kirsten Dunst and Eliza Dushku?
Yeah. I think it's like...
Did you root for them or did you root for Gabrielle Union?
It's a cheerocracy, not a democracy or something. Anyway.
I can never keep it straight if that was actually in the movie or if that was in all of the parodies of it.
I don't know if it matters, but we could...
What movie was it where Jamie Kennedy pretended to be that character?
Was it maybe the one that made fun of the murder?
The Not
stuff?
Another Teen movie, maybe?
Oh, I was gonna guess that he was in the what's the one with Anna Faris? The one that was based on Scream.
Scary Movie?
Yeah. Was it in that? Anyway.
I don't know.
It doesn't matter. But the
anyway, go Clovers.
Scary Movie 2 is very funny. But problematic. But anyway, back to this.
What was happening?
They have threats that have gone back and forth about various things, about stuff. And Dwayne The Rock Johnson is...
Oh, right. He was the witness. Somewhere in here, yeah. Because we need to get to this plot point before we'll get any further in this. Chili and Edie go do a dance thing that looks like Pulp Fiction.
Yeah, the Black Eyed Peas are performing.
Oh, right. The Black Eyed Peas are there.
Mm-hmm.
And then... They conspire to hook up with Aerosmith because she has the tattoo and Aerosmith would be great to partner with Linda Moon to help rocket her career to stardom or something. So he borrows courtside seats from somebody where he gets to sit next to Steven Tyler and they have a really awkward scene where they're like, hey, fancy meeting you here. And she's all like, I wonder if Steven Tyler's going to remember me from when I used to wash their clothes. And he's like, of course I remember you, Edie. Do you still have that tattoo? What was the name of that delicious smelling stuff you used to put in our clothes? Joe
Lavender
still
water.
Talks about that all the time. And it's so stupid. And then they have a scene after the basketball game where they, like, apparently they're just famous, so they get to just hang out in one of the boxes up there and smoke cigars and talk about stuff. And Chili Palmer Aerosmith explains the meaning behind Sweet Emotion mm-hmm. to Steven Tyler.
It's a pretty bold move.
even though, you know, he says, like, Sweet Emotion, that was really about your daughters. But if you listen to literally any of the other words in that song... No. No, John Travolta, no. And Steven Tyler's like, yeah, you might be right. Maybe I was singing about this. Like, no, Steven Tyler, you were there. You made the words. You know damn well that's not what that song is about. And then the scene just ends. It's just like, yeah, it's like when you get really high or something and you're like, what, you know, just think about like the universe, man. And then it just like stops.
See, what I would have preferred is there is actually a moment when John Travolta brings up this crazy plan, that they'll go, you know, she'll go talk to, Steven Tyler, and she's like, oh yeah, and then I'll get the Sting and Bono to do all this other stuff. Like, that's ridiculous. Like, I can't just like go up to these people that I met a long time ago and just have them in these things. They wouldn't remember me. And that would have been a very plausible route for the movie to continue to go down. But instead it said, no, that's just a line of dialogue to fake you out and to make you think that we're not above just bringing in Steven Tyler to do this ridiculousness like a monkey for the rest of this. But that was,
don't forget to hang a lantern on it.
So disappointing. And
I'm not just the kind of guy who just shows up in a movie, man.
Made me so mad. He's been in so many movies. He was in movies before that.
Was he in other movies? What movies he's in?
Can't remember off the top of my head, but he's had cameo appearances elsewhere.
He's on the poster of this movie.
Oh, good for him that he maneuvered his way into such a wonderful position.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
The other thing about this is that when they go to the basketball game, they play Sixpence and the Richer, "Kiss Me," which by this point was, I believe, 8 years old or something. So it was not even like a current reference, but they were like trying to play into it as part of the kiss cam that was on screen. And this was merely an excuse for Danny DeVito, one of the producers on this film, to kiss Anna Nicole Smith on screen. And that seemed like the extent of that.
Is that who he was kissing?
Yes, Anna Nicole Smith. She has a credit in the film for this kiss.
Yes. I mean, everything about that scene is just offensive.
Creatively. It's not good. Maybe this is why everybody felt like they were above the project that they were making, is because they knew this scene was in the movie because of the insistence of a director or producer or something. But, anyway,
you think Danny DeVito was just like, I really want to kiss Anna Nicole Smith. Let's make an entire movie about it.
I'm just saying, I would be very suspect of having Danny DeVito as a producer on any project that I was working on. That's all I'll say.
I know somebody in their teenage years who wrote a 90-page screenplay as an excuse to get to kiss a girl, and it didn't even work.
Was it you?
No, it was not me. But you're not far off.
Okay.
We'll move past
okay.
that.
So, anyway. Wait, did you write a screenplay in order to have an excuse to kiss a girl and it worked? Was that why you said it's not far off?
No, it was not me.
Okay.
Literally wasn't me.
Okay. I don't believe you. But,
I was not the writer of the group.
Okay.
Anyway, so somewhere in here is the part where Chili leaves the message for The Rock saying, you gotta audition for a Nicole Kidman movie, and Vince Vaughn's all mad, and he's in his tiny little room looking for The Rock, and he's not there, and he deletes Chili Palmer's message out of spite.
And says it aloud, so we know that it's happening, because we're the audience.
Because it's a very old answering machine, and he basically just hits the rewind button.
Yeah, I would like to point out this is a movie in 2005. Voicemail.
They have T-Mobile sidekicks.
Yeah, voicemail was well established by this point. This is obviously the writer being used to cliches of storytelling from when he was watching mediums and stuff in the 90s, and then just carrying that on through without really thinking about the mechanics of it in a 2005 setting, because it doesn't really make any sense. But they do have that occur, so that way they can all know that Raji's not to be trusted, and he is duplicitous and will sell out anybody. And that sets up tension for the end scene. But just mechanically speaking, bad scene. This is because he was prompted to get Dwayne The Rock Johnson to help him participate in killing John Travolta because Harvey Keitel is now upset because they've been slighted by getting the back end offer and all that other stuff. And he wants to go after him. Also, he's none too thrilled about the actual events that had occurred inside of his office building, which we should probably talk about because that was the scene prior to this, where Raji tried to get Harvey Keitel killed by calling up Sin on his cell phone and shouting at him.
The Rock told him it would be a good idea to get him out of the way because he's not good anymore, which was, for a minute, you think it's Chili's idea to have the Rock tell Raji to tell him to trick Cedric into trying to kill Harvey Keitel, but it's not. It's just a stupid plan that comes out of nowhere. And all it does is serve to confuse everything. So all of Cedric's boys show up to the office there and threaten him, threaten Harvey Keitel, and then they dangle Vince Vaughn over the edge of the balcony to prove that they mean businesses,
plural.
Which it's that. Sorry, that's a quote from another movie. Mm-hmm. Another very bad movie. But yeah, they don't have the money. He's like, trust me, it's Chili Pomeroy's your money. And yeah, that's basically all you need to know from that scene.
Well,
they're like, it's not me, right?
No, the other thing you need to know from that scene is that the Russians show up.
Oh yes, the Russians show up behind them and point guns, but then they also have guns.
Yes, because they were lured into this by complicated pawn ticket mechanics.
Ah, pawn tickets, they always get you.
Yeah, where the pawn ticket that was given to the police officer by Chili Palmer is redeemed by the police officer inside the Russian guy's place. And it was all set up that gets the Russian guy in trouble with the police. Not in trouble enough that he's arrested or anything, but just in trouble in a general sense. And so he goes with his guys to go shoot Nick Carr because that's who the pawn ticket was made out to. They are none too thrilled that somebody else was already trying to shoot Nick Carr. And so there's a confrontation mainly because the Russian guy uses the N-word, and Cedric the Entertainer is none too entertained, and he shoots the guy several times about his bigotedness, and he has a pretty big monologue about his feelings on the subject, about the contributions of black people to American culture, and how he should not be using those words, and then Dabu shoots another guy by accident, just to deflate the tension. Then they leave because Nick says that it's the other guys, it's Chili Palmer and stuff, and so they skedaddle.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a murder body, so that's the thing. And there, so that ends the main Russian plot because the guy who murdered James Woods is now dead. Now there are just the lackeys left, a couple of lackeys, because one of them got shot too. But that's why Vince Vaughn was given the go ahead and do that stuff and erase the voicemail and all these other shenanigans. And John Travolta has the directing thing because he knows a guy who knows a guy who gets him Seth Green's character, who was supposed to be a director. Who is directing a music video, which is, I don't know how to say this. Dan, do you know what cultural appropriation is?
This movie is, yes.
So when they say, hey, Christina Milian, you're going to be inside of this dress and stand in front of these Chinese characters and dance and stuff and things. And there's going to be some food dragons on the side and they're going to breathe fire. Like that's all part of your music video. Cause you have such deep, relevant cultural roots to that.
Well, you know, it's all for art because Seth Green is apparently the Scorsese of music videos.
Yikes. So
it's what they say in this movie.
Sure is. And Edie and well, John Travolta is there, but Edie is not. But then Harvey Keitel wanders in and he does a weird little dance thing because they're all kind of grooving out to music that's not there. And you can tell because it doesn't match the beat. It's stuff that John Powell added in later when he was scoring the film. So anyway, Harvey Keitel is all grooving out and stuff, and he has a conversation with John Travolta, and he's like, oh, you got to go, you know, we got to discuss this thing, and oh, Edie's already, you know, there. And so John Travolta figures out that means that Edie's held captive, and so he goes off with Harvey Keitel and his bodyguard guy, and then they rendezvous with Vince Vaughn and The Rock and Edie, and The Rock is holding Edie by gunpoint. And for some reason, Harvey Keitel's bodyguard seems to get lost at this point because he doesn't do anything for the remainder of the scene. But he leaves with Harvey Keitel. That's why he's not there, because he gives Harvey Keitel the contract, which is another pawn ticket.
Yeah.
So Harvey Keitel leaves with this guy. And so that leaves just Vince Vaughn and The Rock. And
and it's like, I thought you would think it's funny that I gave you a pawn ticket like the way you gave me one to set me up. And it's, don't worry, though, this one isn't a setup. And it's just like, okay, cool, thanks, bye.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so they have the little thing where Vince Vaughn wants to, you know, kill him and stuff because he's been disrespected and whatever. John Travolta says, oh, well, you know, you're not going to get the whatever tryout thing for the Nicole Kidman stuff. And Dwayne The Rock Johnson, this is news to him. He's like, oh, I haven't even heard about it. And he said, oh, well, I left you a voicemail and I sent you a message on your two-way.
Yes, that's what people called those things back then.
Was it?
Yeah, people used that phrasing.
Oh, goodness gracious. So, Dwayne The Rock Johnson can't figure out his phone works, so Uma Thurman shows him. And then he goes and sees the thing, and he realizes...
It's like Tuesday, 4 p.m., audition.
Yeah.
And she could have just taken it out of his hand and typed it real fast, and he wouldn't have known.
Well, he's not that bright, but he might have noticed some time elapsing. But the important part is he realizes that Vince Vaughn was being duplicitous, and that he doesn't really like that because this is all about his career, and Vince Vaughn is not really like a great guy anyways because he already chased him around a car one time. So they twinkle twinkle baby, they have the what was it he says, be Yeezy, be it's so awful. I hate everything about Vince Vaughn's character.
Doesn't matter, they fight.
Yeah.
Like the gun discharges, well, and shoots a box of fireworks.
Vince Vaughn tries to slap the gun out of The Rock's hands, and it discharges into some fireworks that are on the side next to a fire extinguisher, which is ironic. But they explode, and they set Vince Vaughn on fire, and then he runs out on stage and does a little dance, and then it's apparently kept as part of the music video because we see it later when they are accepting their award, and they play the music video as they're leaving the VMA stage. So
it's just production value is what it is, man.
Right, it is just going that extra mile. So Vince Vaughn set on fire.
Happy accidents, I think they call those.
Sure was.
It looks cool, and also Vince Vaughn probably died.
Maybe. I mean, probably not, otherwise they would have had to like dedicate the music video to Vince Vaughn. I'm sure he wasn't like super well afterwards. But but somehow...
more like he was super well done. Get it? Because like, he got cooked.
Zing. Dan with the zingers. They have the thing, and then they cut.
Don't cook your steaks well done.
No, never do that. You want those to be medium rare.
Generally speaking, yes.
For steak, not for ground meat. But
it kind of depends on the cut. But yes.
Oh, the cut of the ground meat or the cut of the steak.
Cut of the steak.
What cut of the steak would you want to have well done?
No, none.
Oh.
But like your range could be like medium to medium.
Oh, okay. Fair enough.
It's a very wide range.
It's a wide range. But we cut forward to the VMA performance by Christina Milian, where she's doing basically the same thing she was doing in the music video as part of her VMA performance. And Chili Palmer and Edie are in the audience with Sin, Edge Cedric the Entertainer, behind them. And
the performance just goes on, and they're bobbing their heads like dorky old people.
They really should have trimmed all of this.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Then they cut from that to the award presentation by the WMDs and the other guy. Was
Andre Benjamin, whatever his name was.
No. Dabu was there as part of the WMDs.
Oh, it was Wyclef was there.
Yeah. For a second, I forgot Wyclef John's name. But they have the presentation occur, and they cut to Christina Milian in the audience, and they're all standing up, and they're cheering, and you can see Fred Durst behind them clapping.
Yeah, and Gene Simmons is back there, too.
Oh, God. Why? All the buttholes in one place.
To really sell that this is the MTV Video Music Awards.
Yeah. All the popular Video Music Award people of 2005, but definitely not people who had a lot of free time on their schedule in 2005. But
there was also I saw what's his name from Wu-Tang back there too.
Oh, okay. So they go up to she goes up to the stage and accepts the award, and she thanks everybody, and this is especially Chili Palmer, and everybody's happy, even though Sin, Cedric the Entertainer, had tried to murder several people. And they're all best friends now. And The Rock does a special dance as part of the music thing because it somehow relates to the Chinese theme that they have going on, even though that's not actually what it is. But
yeah,
it's very strange.
He's got a grass skirt. He's doing his thing.
Again, also threatened murder, dumped a body, accessory to murder. So it's all just amazing. But then as they're really happy and pleased with themselves, they drive off, and we get a billboard of The Rock with Nicole Kidman starring in Samoan Rendezvous, which is a hilarious poster. I'll give them that. It made me laugh because it was so bad.
Incredibly 2005 looking poster. Like all of the posters for the movies in this movie look exactly the same. They all have that like slanted like impact text with like light streaks coming from them.
Well, there was some serif on the Samoan Rendezvous. But anyway, that's the end of that. And then we get clips of everybody enjoying themselves to music as the credits roll. And that is also super frustrating to sit through. But I did it in the event that there would be something important. And there wasn't. So I could have turned it off, I guess.
Yeah.
The end.
This movie happened.
It was a movie.
You know, I'm rediscovering the new ways in which Fred Durst has become problematic. Have you followed up with him lately?
I have elected to not pay attention to Fred Durst in over 15 years.
Yeah.
So no.
I would like to read you something from 2015, if I may.
Oh. Please do. And by please do, I mean don't. But go ahead anyways, because you're going to do it, because you're clearing your throat.
In 2015, Fred Durst stated his interest in obtaining a Russian passport and spending half of the year in Crimea. He wrote a letter in which he stated that Vladimir Putin is a great guy with clear moral principles and a nice person. Following that, Fred Durst was banned by the Security Service of Ukraine from entering Ukraine for 5 years in the interest of guaranteeing the security of the country. Soon thereafter, all Limp Bizkit sales on the territory of Ukraine were prohibited. Probably, I mean, for the best, honestly.
Yeah.
Yeah. As of 2016, he's vegan, by the way.
He's vegan?
Yeah.
Oh, good.
He makes movies as well. He makes some indie movies. Apparently, one of them starred John Travolta.
Oh, goodness gracious. Yeah. There's some really unsavory people in Hollywood, FYI. Also, Dan, I have one further final connection to something
ahead.
I should highlight to you.
Oh, who was in Star Trek in this movie?
No one in this movie was in Star Trek.
Oh, my God.
Someone who worked on this movie was in Star Trek.
Oh, well, there you go.
Jeffrey L. Kimball was the cinematographer for Star Trek Nemesis, the 2002 movie.
That is the name of Harrison Ford's character from The Fugitive.
Star Trek Nemesis is a weird name.
Hmm. Yeah, exactly. Put it on APB for Star Trek Nemesis.
I like her comedy routine. Full-scale
search of every outhouse, train house for Star Trek. Whatever the line is.
Oh, God. We do good work. Jeffrey L. Kimball. Anyway, he's the cinematographer of many things, Beverly Hills Cop, etc.
That's right. I know that name.
Yeah, he did Star Trek Nemesis. Now I have no major complaints with his work on Star Trek Nemesis. Star Trek Nemesis itself is a poop fire. But
is that the one with what's his name where he was weird looking?
Tom Hardy.
Yeah, Tom Hardy.
Yeah. Yeah, Tom Hardy, and it's directed by a guy who did not care. And again, who was above the material he was directing. So he didn't give two craps about anything that was happening.
Speaking of Tom Hardy, did you see Venom yet?
I have not. I know people who like it. I'm kind of vaguely interested to watch it based on that alone. But I don't really have time in my schedule for that.
Yeah, you should watch it. Just make sure you have a drink.
Fair enough.
Stupid movie.
All right. Well, I think that concludes our discussion of Be Cool. And I'm really just regretting the fact that you insisted that we watch this.
I did not insist that we watch this. I told you there were three good Elmore Leonard movies. We watched them, and then we're like, oh, well, the other one's real bad. I didn't even realize. I had no conception last week of how bad this movie really was. I knew it was bad. I thought I had seen all of it. I clearly had not seen all of it somehow. I don't know how I saw it or where I saw it or why I saw it, but this movie is a pile of trash.
Yeah. No, this
But there are a lot of people involved in it that are reasonable actors and directors and cinematographers. Can't really speak to Mr. Steinfeld.
No, but
this movie turned into a very bad. It's the worst possible version of what it could have been.
Yes, and like to your point, it's weird that it involves so many talented people who are doing bad things. And this is the start of Dwayne The Rock Johnson's career. I believe this is the last time that he is credited as The Rock in something. He does do the eyebrow thing, but this is the last time I believe he's credited as The Rock, and he is in the future credited as Dwayne The Rock Johnson, and then finally Dwayne Johnson on all the modern era stuff. So this started that trend for him. And you got your John Travolta, who has been in better and worse things, and you've got Uma Thurman, who has been in better and worse things, and you've got Danny DeVito, again, better and worse things.
Vince Vaughn, things.
Yeah, well, let's not even try to grade that one. But and
Cedric the Entertainer.
Yeah,
you know? Steven Tyler.
Yeah.
Oh, Paul Addleston. He plays the awkward music producer. He's been in things.
If he has, I don't know if I've noticed, and I don't care to notice. He's
kind of just like that guy in a lot of stuff.
Okay. Well, but the
He was a bad guy on Law and Order SVU a lot of times. Well, twice, but over a long period of time, it looks like.
Yeah, I always wonder how that goes, because if you ever look at some people's IMDb stuff, it's like they've been a bad guy on Law and Order, and then a bad guy on Law and Order SVU twice, and then a bad guy on like Law and Order Criminal Minds. You're like, how did you do this?
He was a dentist who did bad things.
Oh,
to somebody who was his niece.
Oh my God, I remember this from I was watching like a Law and Order marathon. The dentist one. Holy crap, that was him.
Yeah, I remember because there's DNA on her sweater. And
oh.
He's like, well, you know, I just wiped it up. And,
no.
Oh, gosh, this is 2015. Why do I remember this? See, Amanda loves every Saturday or Sunday whenever they do the SVU marathon, she fires that up. And it's just like, ugh.
I used to turn it on a lot when I was just like doing stuff around the house for like busy work noise. And
it's a bad show.
It's a bad show in totality, where there is a very predictable formulaic structure to it, but at the same time, it's very comforting to know that there's a predictable formulaic structure to it, because it means you can dip in and dip out at any point you want to, and you'll figure it all out.
It doesn't make you feel good when you're watching it.
Well,
all, ever.
Sometimes justice is served, and sometimes justice is not. So the ones where justice is served, you feel good.
Even when justice is served, it's like 4 minutes out of this hour-long catastrophe of a show.
Agree to disagree. I think it's been pretty successful for a reason.
Because people like messed up stuff.
Yeah. Well, people want to see messed up stuff happen, and then they want to see somebody get punished.
I don't want that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the world wants that, Dan. America wants it. America. Anywho.
Fred Durst played a bartender in 2 episodes of House MD.
I'm sorry, that prolonged silence was just me trying to fish for a thought on that, and I mm-hmm. found nothing.
Mm-hmm.
I came up with nothing in the hot dog flavored water. So,
you wanna feel old?
I was gonna say,
photo from 1999.
Wrap this episode was what I was gonna say.
Yeah, we should let's push the button for the show.
Yeah, this photo of Fred Durst with Christina Aguilera.
1999.
Yeah.
It's 20 years ago. I had those shoes, by the way.
Fred Durst's shoes or Christina Aguilera's shoes?
What do you think?
Fred Durst's.
Yeah, it doesn't matter, though. Some girl stole
Look
them
at those
me.
Cargo shorts. Those are some long cargo shorts.
They're not so much long as, like, not pulled up appropriately.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
Mm-hmm.
Sagging played an important part in one shot of this film.
It played an important part in a lot of people's lives in that era. Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's when Uma Thurman was going down the staircase and she had the Echo Domani cheap white wine over her shoulder, ready to hit somebody with it. And
I like how quickly you identified the wine, by the way.
It is a very recognizable logo.
I thought I recognized the bottle, but I thought she had it backwards most of the time, too. So I was like, show me the front of that again.
No, it is a very recognizable split circle logo. And so anyway, she's going down the stairs with the Echo Domani bottle. And I'm sure Echo Domani did not pay them for product placement for this. But it's just happens to be something you can recognize. They should have done something clever and made it like a private label of chili or something. But
Chili Palmer's private wine.
Yes.
Hmm.
You know what he could do? He could do his own take on the Arnold Palmer. He could get into beverages in the third movie. It could be lemonade and iced tea with a little cayenne pepper. And then that way it's like a master cleanse combined with an Arnold Palmer. And then you get the Chili Palmer.
I'm glad you got that out of your system.
Yeah. Any other ideas for a sequel, Dan?
No.
No thirst for another?
No.
Okay.
Actually, I would like to follow Fred Durst's character in the sequel. He does an album with Christina Milian's character.
Don't want to see him ever again.
Yeah.
He's got but a beard now. Or hear
He's
about
got a big old beard now.
I don't want to hear about him, see him, nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Disappear into a void, Fred.
Mm-hmm.
He's
got a beard and no hair.
Okay. Crazy old man. Goodbye. No more of him. And with that, Dan, I have to instruct you one last time. Be cool.
No.
I like your disgust.